We're nearing the end of Judges, and as we've kind of laid out, the section we're at now is the last section of the book. It's the third section, and in the third section, the author basically gives us a picture into what caused the stuff that we spent the bulk of our time on. The bulk of our time was spent looking at individual judges and this cycle of apostasy that Israel had gone through, where they would turn their backs on the Lord. The Lord would then oppress them through their enemies. They would then cry out to Him. Then He would respond by delivering them from their enemies, and then they would start the whole process over again. And so, in the last section of this book, the last five chapters, the author gives us a picture as to why that took place. What was going on in Israel? You know, those of us that have kids obviously know that sin is a heart-based issue. What's in their heart is what comes out in their behavior. And it's the same thing with us adults. You know, I think Kimberly at one time asked me, you know, why we sin? And I said, because we like to. You know, it's basically what's in our heart and our minds that actually cause us to do things. And so there's no question that with Israel, the pattern of behavior through the book of Judges is a heart condition, which ultimately means that it's a spiritual condition. And so the author, in the first of the five chapters here, in the first two, chapter 17 and 18, he deals with spiritual corruption and gives us an idea of what was happening spiritually in Israel that would lead them to do the things they were doing. In the last three chapters, which will be the next 2 weeks for us, he deals with the moral corruption. And there's a reason why he takes it in that order. Because when there's a problem spiritually, we have a problem morally. And so morals follow the spiritual issues. And so he covers that in this a little bit. He first tells us about their spiritual condition, then he's going to tell us about their moral condition. So last week when we looked at chapter 17 and we began this journey on the spiritual corruption of Israel, we saw three individuals. We saw Micah's mother, we saw Micah, and then we saw a Levite priest. And we saw that the primary emphasis of that passage was that with their mouth or with their declaration, with who they claimed to be, they were Yahweh worshippers, or they were worshippers of Israel's God, Yahweh. But that was more in mouth or in the way that they expressed themselves verbally or with their identity, but it didn't match their behavior. And we saw that in each one of those individuals, they lived in such a way that was offensive to God. And the author told us that it was because they simply chose to do what was right in their own eyes. And so spiritually, they just did what was in their own eyes. So we're going to continue that today, and we're going to see through another group of individuals something very similar, and it's the group called the Danites. They were one of the tribes of Israel. So go ahead and turn to Judges chapter 18. Our passage today starts with a rather disheartening tone. If you look at chapter 18, verses 1 and 2, it says, "In those days there was no king of Israel, and in those days the tribes of the Danites was seeking an inheritance for themselves to live in, for until that day an inheritance had not been allotted to them as a possession among the tribes of Israel. So the sons of Dan sent from their family 5 men out of their whole number, valiant men from Zorah and Eshtal, to spy out the land, to search it. And they said to them, 'Go search the land.' And they came to the hill country of Ephraim, to the house of Micah, and lodged there." So that's our introduction. We're introduced to this group called the Danites. But it starts off with this interesting phrase: "In those days, there was no king in Israel." Now, this phrase actually appears 4 or 5 times in the book of Judges. Sometimes it's followed up with, "and they did what was right in their own eyes." So think of this opening phrase as sort of a shortened version of what the author has already said. He doesn't need to repeat for us that because there was no king, they simply did what was right in their own eyes. But that's the point. And so it's this rather disheartening way to introduce us to the Danites, is this idea that, remember guys, there was no king, which means that what we're going to see now is a group of individuals simply doing what was right in their own eyes. And the reason that the author does this is it's probably written by Samuel. And Samuel is looking probably from the perspective of King David back. Because if you remember, Samuel was one of the judges after this book. What follows this book is 1 Samuel. And we have Eli, and then we have Samuel as the next two judges. And Samuel is the last judge before Israel demands a king, and Saul comes to power, and then after that whole debacle with Saul, we end up with David. And so Samuel is living during the time of David's reign, and sees a godly king in David. And he sees how that tempered Israel, that once they had a godly leader in somebody like David, Israel was much better off. And so he's looking back from that perspective and saying, the time I'm telling you about right now with these Danites, the story I'm going to cover today, happened at a time when there was no king. And that led them ultimately to do what was right in their own eyes, which was not a positive thing. And so he's looking back, and so he introduces that to us with this, again, rather disheartening tone, and it sort of tells us what to expect. So, let's talk about these Danites here. It says in verse 2 that they were seeking an inheritance for themselves to live in. Now, there's something strange about this statement, because if you remember when we studied through the book of Joshua, I won't have you turn here, but Joshua chapter 19 spells out the land that had been given to the Danites. They had already been given an inheritance. Remember when Joshua had come into the land and taken Israel in? He divided the land up based on the boundaries that Moses had set. When they first came out of Egypt, Moses told them what land they would inherit when they came into the land of Canaan. It was broken out by their tribes. And so Joshua repeats that. And he begins to send, as sort of his last commission to Israel, he sends out the Israelite tribes to go and conquer their areas. Because during the conquest, they basically tackled the big city-states, sort of the military powers. And once those were knocked out, then the Canaanites didn't have quite as much influence or power anymore, because their military headquarters had been torn down. So the next step of the conquest was for the individual Israelite tribes to go out and conquer their areas. And so they were supposed to move into those areas and then basically kick the rest of the Canaanites out of those areas. Because they had, militarily, they had been somewhat defeated. And God promised them that as long as you do this, if you make it your goal to go and kick these people out of the land, push them out of the land, I will do that for you. I'll kick them out. You just have to be obedient in doing it. So in Joshua chapter 19, we see the division given to the land, or given to the Danites. They were given a specific area. Now what's interesting is the New American Standard is one of the few versions of your Bible that actually translate verses 2 and 3 in a way that seem to indicate that they hadn't been given an inheritance yet. Almost every other translation translates it differently, and they all translate it very similar, that the Danites had failed to conquer their land. There's a difference with that. So I want you to sort of ignore what's in the New American Standard this morning on that, and rather focus on what the other translations do. In fact, the NET, the New English Translation, I think does probably the finest job, because it simply says, the Danites failed to conquer their territory. So that's really what's happening here. The author is telling us that the Danites had a problem. They had not been obedient to the Lord. They had not kicked out the Amorites. In fact, if you go back, and you don't have to turn here, I'll mention this to you. Joshua chapter 19, verses 47, indicates that they had not done exactly that. But also, in Judges chapter 1:34, we find out that the Amorites, they were the primary people living, the primary Canaanites living in the Danites area. And the Amorites had oppressed the Israelites and forced them out of the high country, out of the valley, which is the best part to live, and pushed them up into the mountains. And so the picture really is that the Danites, because they were disobedient to the Lord, hadn't trusted Him, were forced out of their own land. So instead of responding in obedience and crying out to God, asking other Israelite tribes to now help them, because the Israelite tribes were told to help one another to drive out these inhabitants, well, nobody had done that. And so the Danites came up with this idea. They still wanted a place to live. So because they had trouble in their own land, they basically set out to steal land from another tribe. That's what's happening here. They brought some men forward and they said, we want you to go and search out some land for us. That's the end of verse 2. And so they send them out and they come into the land of Ephraim, the hill country of Ephraim. Well, Ephraim is another tribe. So the Danites, who are basically, if you looked at a map, the Danites are close to the Mediterranean Sea. Okay, so they're basically in the west. Ephraim is immediately to the east of them. So they basically went into Ephraim starting to look for land, to steal land from their brothers in Ephraim. But what ultimately ends up happening is they actually go a little bit further north, about 100 miles north, into another tribe, Manasseh, and they conquer a city up there and take that as their own. So what we have right now are these Danites who, because they were disobedient, because they hadn't relied upon God, they hadn't done what God had asked them to do. In fact, God would have driven out the Amorites had they done their job. God promised them that He would. And so the only conclusion we can come to is, since the Amorites were still in control of that area, they hadn't done their job. They hadn't relied on God. So we basically find here in these first just two verses or so that these Danites ran into some difficulty. So now they're on a quest to steal land from another tribe and make it their own. They were going to get theirs is the best way to kind of describe that. So look at verses 3 through 6. When they were near the house of Micah now is the guy we talked about last week. He lives in the hill country of Ephraim. When they came near his house, they recognized the voice of a young man, the Levite, and they turned aside there and said to him, "Who brought you here?" And what are you doing in this place? And what do you have here? He said to them, thus and so has Micah done to me, and he has hired me, and I have become his priest. They said to him, inquire of God, please, that we may know whether our way on which we are going will be prosperous. The priest said to them, go in peace, your way in which you are going has the Lord's approval. So as the search party travels through Ephraim, they come to Micah's house, and they discover something that catches their attention. They hear this voice, and they go, we kind of recognize that voice. It doesn't say why they might have recognized it. You know, there are different Hebrew dialects, and it may have been that this particular priest, because of where he is from, spoke a certain Hebrew dialect, and so it caught their attention. Could have been an accent, or it could have been that they were even familiar with them. We don't really know. All it says is that they recognized the voice of this priest. Now, their questions indicate that this priest was out of place. I think we talked about this last week. The Levites were not given any of their own land. They were given cities, but they weren't given land, much like the tribe of Dan or the tribe of Ephraim. Instead, the Levites were given cities in each one of the lands, because the Levites were the spiritual leaders, if you will, of Israel. So what God did was he took and gave 11 of the tribes their areas, and then took the Levites, or sorry, 12 of them, but then took the Levites and sprinkled them throughout Israel. And so in Ephraim, where we're at right now, there were 4 of these cities. And that's where the priests were supposed to live. This priest wasn't living in one of those cities. That's our first indication that there's a problem. We saw this last week that he was a bit of an enterprising priest. He was a priest for hire. In other words, he was going to work for somebody, make his living. But that's not the way God established the Levites to live. They were to serve the community. They weren't supposed to be in private practice. They weren't supposed to be hired by an individual just to be his personal priest to do his bidding. So they, even these Danites recognize that there's a problem because of some of the questions they ask him. You know, what are you doing here? What's going on? So they recognize that there was a problem with this. And his answer to them is, well, basically Michael's hired me. This is what he's done for me. He's hired me, and I've become his priest. Now, because they recognize there's a problem, you would almost expect these Danites now to say, now, wait a minute, there's a problem here. But instead, they do something that's rather interesting. Recognizing that this priest is out of place, that he's been assigned or working for a particular individual, which again was not from the law, they ask him to inquire of God about their quest. You notice that they actually use the word God there. It's the Hebrew word Elohim. It's very generic, typically. And there's a reason for that. Remember what this priest was doing? Michael had idols in his house. And some of those idols, the household idols, were called teraphim. And they were used for divining. They were basically, they represented gods, plural. And so, if you wanted to know what the gods thought of you, or if the gods were going to bless you, or if the gods were happy with you, you would consult these teraphim. And so what these Danites actually do is, recognizing that this Levite has teraphim in Micah's house, ask him to consult the teraphim on the Lord's behalf, Yahweh. They don't use the word Yahweh. They just call him God. So they're asking this priest now to divine, to do something that's against the law, to inquire of God in a sort of generic sense, to find out if he's going to honor their plan. And what does the priest say to him? Verse 6, go in peace. Your way in which you are going has the Lord's approval. Now let me ask you this. What do you think the chances are that this priest actually went and talked to the Lord and came back with an answer for him? He was an idol worshiper, working in private practice, and the text doesn't tell us that he even consulted the Lord. In fact, he gives him an immediate answer. Ah, you've got the Lord's approval. I suspect, because he's a priest for hire, what do you suppose that priest for hire is going to say and do when people ask him? Generally, you tell them what they want to hear. You know? And so that's exactly what happens in this text. Is he pretty much responds, oh, you've got the Lord's approval. Now, we know that's probably not true because they're on their way to steal land from somebody else. God certainly doesn't put his stamp of approval on that. They were disobedient in their own land, hadn't been honoring God. Plus, the whole entire context of these few chapters, and in fact, the book as a whole is the disobedience of Israel and their apostasy and God constantly having to correct them. And so it's highly unlikely here that God had spoken to this priest. What he had probably done was simply appeased the men for their favor. Go. The Lord's happy with you. Now, we do have other examples of that in the Old Testament where priests don't speak on behalf of God. In fact, the priests are chastised. A number of places in the biblical text where God says, they don't speak on my behalf. And that's exactly what we have here. So we have this Levite continuing to do what he believed was right in his own eyes. And you have the Danites here doing what they thought was right in their own eyes. And what I find striking about this is that the Old Testament actually laid out instructions for the high priest and the priest to ask God questions and get answers. And this priest would have been well aware of it. How many of you are familiar with the Uman or the Thuman? Does that ring a bell? Basically, we don't know if they're dice or stones that the high priest would wear in his garment. And they could inquire of God. They could ask God a question and toss the dice, and God would answer the question through the dice. That's the Old Testament law's system of them being able to ask God a question. You know, that's something that we don't really get. I wish that as Christians we could simply say, you know, Lord, I'm going to hear your voice now and talk to me that way. Instead, he's given us other ways to determine his will, and, you know, he reveals it through the New Testament and other things. But we don't have the benefit of being able to basically open up our little garment, take out two little dice, and say, okay, God, should I do this or do that, and throw the dice. But that's what God offered to the old. This priest could have gone over, found the high priest, and said, we got a question for you know, we don't know if God is with these guys. Can you take out your dice and throw them so that we can figure out what God... Is he an approval of this or disapproval? So what's striking to me about that is they had this proven way of talking to God and knowing that God honored it and could answer it. And they rejected that for something as just nutso as a carving and a bunch of wooden or engraven images that were handmade by some smith somewhere that couldn't talk, that couldn't do anything at all. And they were willing to consult that and rely on some priest for hire's word. Kind of interesting how we sometimes do that, isn't it? We take the good or the best and we give it up for something less than that. And that's exactly what you find here. And we've seen that throughout the whole entire book so far, as Israel, being called out by God and given every blessing in him, decides to turn their back on that and worship these plaster, or not plastic, but wooden, graven, molten, cast images that don't even represent him. They give up the best for something terrible, actually. And so we find that here with these Danites as they approach this Levite here. So the Levite basically says, oh, sure, you got God's favor. Go ahead and do what you want to do. And so with that, they now are emboldened on their journey to conquer this land. So look at verses 7 through 10. So with this newfound approval by God, supposedly, the five men depart and come to a place called Laish and saw people who were in it sitting in security after the manner of the Sidonians. Sidonians were a Canaanite group. Basically means that this was a Sidonian city, or basically a Canaanite city that had been similar, had been affected by the Sidonians, much like a culture. If you go back to Israel in the first century, it was Romanized. There were many Roman things in the culture there, even though it was Israel. Same type of thing here, where it's a small Canaanite city, resembled the Sidonians. They were quiet and secure, for there was no ruler humiliating or oppressing them for anything in the land, and they were far from the Sidonians, had no dealings with anyone. So basically, they come across this city that literally has no oppression. They're living in, they're kind of living high off the hog, if you will. Things are good for them. They don't have any oppressors real close to them. Nobody's really bothering them, and there's plenty in the land. So it's probably a good-looking city, a lot there to be desirous of. And the other nice thing about it is the Canaanites that sort of were in control of that area were somewhat far away, meaning that this was a little area that was unaffected by the oppressors, the Sidonians. So it's a fairly relatively safe area, is the best way to describe it. So verse 8, when they, meaning these men of Danites, came back to their brothers at Zorah and Eshtol, they said to them, what do you report? And they said, arise, let us go up against them, meaning this small city, for we have seen the land, and behold, it is very good, and will you sit still? Do not delay and go, to enter, to possess the land. When you enter, you will come to a secure people with a spacious land, for God has given it into your hand, a place where there is no lack of anything that is on the earth. So what do we basically find here? Well, they find this small little city, and they say it's good. It's a secure people, meaning that they were unworthy. They were trustworthy and unsuspecting. The language that's used here means that they don't expect anybody to attack them because they're worried about the Sidonians and they're far away. So we can go in and just conquer this land with no problem at all. So it was appealing to them. There was no lack of anything in the earth, which means it was a fairly wealthy city in some respects. But they also claim that God had given it into their hands. So the question I have to ask is, what could possibly be wrong with this picture? Well, first we have to remember that they were taking land that was not allotted to them. This land that they were in right now, this city, was a part of the Manasseh tribe, which is north of Ephraim. It wasn't their land to take. But yet, they were taking it. God's going to favor us. Well, highly unlikely, because they were stealing the land. Second, they had failed to conquer their own land due to their lack of obedience and faith. So they're looking at these Amorites who they're having difficulty with, and instead of relying on God to drive them out, go find a place that they can do it all on their own. That's pretty much what they're saying here. This will be an easy one for us. Now, granted, they should have been driven out of the land, this people, these Canaanites. But the perspective of the Danites here is that they actually are looking at something very easy that they can do under their own power. They could have driven out the Amorites under God's authority and God's power, but they chose not to, and instead find this small little city where they can do it all on their own. Another problem with this is they asked an idol-worshipping priest to use divination to tell them that God was okay with what they were about to do. So they find this defenseless and unsuspecting city that they could easily conquer themselves, and then claimed it must be the hand of God. No, because it was easy. And we're going to see that that's exactly what happens here. I think about this, and I wish I could say that we're never guilty of doing some similar things. Now, I can speak on behalf of myself. Sometimes, you know, if I look at my behavior, and, you know, I'm much like the Apostle Paul when you think about his struggle with sin. I do the things I don't want to do, and I do the things I don't want to do. And it's a thing that happens. You know, we still live in the flesh, don't we? I hope I'm not alone in this. There are just some times where we ignore God's laws and whatnot, and we go ahead and we do things under our own ability and our own power, and somehow we even sometimes think that God's on our side and God favors us in spite of that. I think I shared this with you before, and I'll leave the name out, but I got a phone call not too long ago from an individual, an old friend, who called me to ask if I was interested in marrying him and his fiance. What was interesting about this is I hadn't seen him in quite a few years, but he had, as he's talking to me on the phone, we were talking about his life, what his life has been like lately is the best way to describe it. And he began to explain to me how he had made some deliberate decisions to turn his back on the Lord and to live out the flesh. And he was fairly pointed about it. Didn't hide any of it. Told me the details, the women and all the other things that he was involved with, and quite a bit of alcohol involved with it as well, and a lot of nights out at bars. And as he described all this to me, he continued to repeat the same refrain, but I was being honest with God about it, so he was okay. And it was shocking even coming from this individual. But he kept insisting that because he was being genuine and honest with God, I told God I was rebelling, and so he was cool with it. He was okay with it. So after a number of women and inappropriate relationships and activity with them, and this time out living in the world and absorbing the world and basically indulging his flesh, in his own words, that's exactly what he was doing. He ends up meeting this woman through his church. And immediately they begin sleeping together and she moves in with him. But you see, God's okay with that because he's being honest with God about his struggles. And so after 2 months they decide they wanted to marry. And so as he describes this to me, he wants my opinion and thoughts because some of his friends were judging his behavior and he didn't think that was right. So I'm being asked for my opinion because, in his words, I respect your opinion, Mike. I don't know that I'm going anywhere where their friends haven't already gone. Now, my point in bringing this up was I had to turn him down because the advice I gave him, I said, well, I'll tell you what. I said, if you really, really love this woman, then you ought to start treating her like the Bible says you ought to treat a woman. And stop borrowing things that don't belong to you yet because she's not your wife. And I try to say that in a way that your parents might understand what I'm getting at. So I said, the thing is, she should probably move out of the house, or you should. Why don't you separate for a while and then spend the next 6 months courting and getting to know each other in a godly fashion? And his response was, well, I don't have to do that because we already know each other because, and this is the funny part, we hiked the Appalachian Trail together. That's the kind of thinking that we're dealing with here. So, and I don't say this to mock him, but I'm using the absurd to make an absurd point here. We laugh at that, and we want to point our finger at that and kind of say, yeah, okay, you did something wrong there. But how many times do we find ourselves kind of doing some similar things where we behave in a certain way or we do something in a certain way, and we just somehow think that God is okay with it, and we don't really stop to ask, is God really, really okay with this? Is God really directing my behavior right now rather than me just doing what's right in my own eyes? Because remember, the story of this book is that they just kept doing what was right in their own eyes. And that's really what we see here. These Danites are simply doing what's right in their own eyes, and God's okay with it. And they come right out and say, God's given us this land. But again, there's so many things wrong with what they're doing. How could God possibly be okay with it? And then ultimately, what's really interesting about this is when they go in, they conquer the city, they're able to do just that. Boy, that puts a stamp of approval on it, because if we did it, God must be God's plan, right? And sometimes we do that too. And that was kind of the argument from this individual was, well, how could God not be okay? He brought her to me. He introduced me to her. Must be of God. So everything must be okay. No, not necessarily. Just because things happen a certain way doesn't mean that God is okay with them. And so that's kind of what the Danites were doing here. So they lead this military quest against this small city. And so their quest leads to a military victory, but it ultimately leads to spiritual depravity. Go ahead and we'll look at the last section here, 11 through 31. Then from the family of Danites, from Zorah and Eshtaol, 600 men with armed weapons of war set out. They went up and camped at the city there in Judah. There they called that place Mechonadan. To this day, behold, it's west of Kirjath-Jearim. They passed from there to the hill country of Ephraim and came to the house of Micah. So basically, they're now setting out on this journey. They haven't attacked the city yet. They're now setting out to go attack this city. Because remember, it was only the 5 men that had gone out and spied on it. They went back, said, hey, let's go take this small little city. So now the army's going to march up there and do that. So as they're going along their way, they come back to Micah's house. Then the 5 men who went to spy out the country of Laish said to the kinsmen, the men who were with them now going up this army, do you know that in these houses there is an ephod and household idols and a graven image and a molten image? Now therefore, consider what you should do. Let's stop right there. So as they're marching, they come back to Micah's house and they say, okay guys, you know what's in this house? There are golden images there. There's graven images. There's all kinds of household idols. You know what to do. What should we expect with that? What would you expect them to basically do? These are Israelites told not to worship idols. Destroy it, right? That's what you expect. But instead, something else happens. The 600 men of war that are there go to the door and guard the door just in case Micah comes back, because now they're going to loot his idols. So, you know what to do, men. Well, what they knew to do was go take the idols. Let's make them our own. So that's exactly what they do. So it says, the 600 men armed with their weapons of war who were of the sons of Dan stood by the entrance of the gate. Verse 16. Now the 5 men who went to spy out the land went up and entered there and took the graven images and the ephod and the household idols and the molten image, while the priest stood by the entrance of the gate with the 600 men armed with weapons of war. So they basically took the priest, stood him out of the gate, guarded the gate, make sure that Micah doesn't come back, and then the 5 men go in and loot the house. Basically take all the idols. When these went into Micah's house and took the graven image, the ephod, the household idols, and the molten image, and the priest said to them, what are you doing? They said to him, be silent. In other words, shut up. Put your hand over your mouth and come with us. And oh, by the way, we've got a job for you. It says, and be to us a father and a priest. Is it better for you to be a priest of the house of one man or to be the priest of a tribe and a family of Israel? Think about that. What a deal. Here's this enterprising young priest, priest for hire, working for one guy. Yeah, it's a good deal. You know, he gets his 10 shekels of silver every year, and he gets his housing allowance, and he gets his clothes, it says, and everything he needs. It's a pretty sweet deal. He doesn't have to serve a tribe. He has to serve one guy. He probably gets paid vacations for all we know. That's a good deal. But what could be better than that? Hey, how about a bigger house? How about more salary? How about more people to work with? Everybody will know your name. So the appeal to this priest's ego, if you will, wouldn't it be better? Why serve just one small household when you can serve many? So they offer this priest a job to become their personal priest. So it says in verse 20, the priest's heart was glad. And he took the ephod and the household idols and the graven image and went among the people. Of course, if he's going to leave, he certainly has to take his images with him. How can he consult the gods, right? Verse 21, then they turned and departed and put the little ones and the livestock and the valuables in front of them. When they had gone some distance from the house of Micah, the men who were in the houses near Micah's house assembled and overtook the sons of Dan. In other words, Micah came back home, realized all his stuff had been stolen, gets his neighbors and said, guys, they stole my stuff. So now they got to go and chase after these men to get their stuff back. So verse 23, they cried to the sons of Dan, who turned around and said to Micah, what's the matter with you? Why have you assembled together? That's kind of a ridiculous statement. He knows he stole all of his stuff. Verse 24, he said, have you taken away the idols, or you have taken away the idols, or the gods that I've made, and the priest, and you've gone away. What do I have besides? Isn't that kind of a sad statement? In other words, you took my priest and all my idols. What do I have now? I got nothing. So he says, what is the matter with you? Verse 25, the sons of Dan said to him, do not let your voice be heard among us, or else fierce men will fall upon you and you will lose your life with the lives of your household. So basically, the Danites' response is, so what? We got your stuff. What are you going to do about it? Either turn around and go home, or we'll kill you and your household. Well, now that sounds like God's part of that plan too, right? Of course God's happy with that. Right? No, what we see here throughout this story are Danites doing what was right in their own eyes. Now, what's really striking about this text is it really looks like it's about the conquest of Dan trying to find land, trying to find their inheritance. Okay? There's 31 verses in this chapter. Two-thirds of them deal with the idolatry. Did you catch that? Only a third of the verses are really about the quest to get their own land. The author spends twice as much time, two-thirds of this section, describing activity related specifically to their adultery, or their idolatry, their spiritual corruption. It gives us an idea of how we're supposed to understand this text, what we're supposed to focus on. So really, the text isn't so much about their desire to go conquer the land and to find their inheritance. The author is really focusing on their spiritual and moral corruption. And remember how he started it off in verse 1? There's no king. And the implied there is that, so each one did what was right in his own eyes. So the last two chapters that we've looked at here have focused on this spiritual depravity that affected Israel throughout their history. In chapter 17, we saw Micah and his mother and an introduction to this Levite priest claiming to be worshipers of Yahweh but not living in that way. They simply did what was right in their own eyes. Today we see something similar with the Danites. They're given an inheritance of their own, but when they sort of tried to do it on their own, they couldn't drive out the inhabitants. And instead of going back to God and saying, God, you promised us this. What must we do? And relying on God and the other Israelite tribes to help them do what God commanded them to do, they take the easy road. They say, you know what? It'd be much easier to go up there. There's some areas that aren't really parole, or aren't really watched much by the Canaanites. They're kind of alone. We'll go take one of those cities and make it our own. It's the easy thing to do. And oh, by the way, it doesn't matter that it happens to be somebody else's land, one of the other tribes. We're going to just take it from them. What could they care? So they did as well what was right in their own eyes. What does this do for us here? What's interesting is if you look at Romans chapter 1, it says that mankind loves to suppress the truth of God and unrighteousness. In other words, they do what's right in their own eyes. They take the truth of God and they suppress it, they push it down, and they say, no, we're going to do what's right in our eyes. But they're not the only ones who struggle with that. In fact, the church struggles with that too. I'm going to give you some examples here. As you think about the New Testament, much of the New Testament is corrective in nature, having to correct this idea of doing what's right in our own eyes. Because even Christians struggle sometimes in doing what's right in our own eyes. Isn't that really the case when we sin? What is it? We do what's right in our own eyes at that moment, and then we have to come back around and go, oh, that was kind of stupid, and it was sinful, and now I got to repent of it and confess. So I'm just going to run through this real quickly here, but the Corinthians struggled with lawsuits against one another, turning the Lord's Supper into this gluttony feast. They had sexual immorality in the church. They abused their Christian liberty, and they made a mess out of spiritual gifts, doing whatever they thought was right in their own eyes. The Galatians got caught up in legalism. They perverted the gospel by claiming that Christ wasn't enough. We now have to work for our salvation too. You have the Ephesians who struggled with living out their life in a way that honored Christ, and instead they were falling back into old patterns of sin. That's why he said you have to put off that old man and put on the new man. They fell back into patterns of doing what was right in their own eyes. The Colossians were falling prey to false teaching and religious practices. In fact, were getting themselves involved with practices that actually included hurting their own bodies as a way of getting closer to God. And so they did what was right, again, in their own eyes. Paul had to correct the theology of the Thessalonians because of their misunderstanding of Christ and what was happening with that. And Paul even had to challenge Timothy about the false teachers who were teaching what was right in their own eyes. You get a picture here? God knows that we struggle with this. He knew that Israel would struggle with it, which is probably why he was so patient with Israel. You know, he was long-suffering. We saw how many judges that, you know, God would raise up and they would just keep doing the same thing over and over and over again, doing what's right in their own eyes, and God still continued to rescue them and deliver them, be patient with them. There was chastisement, no doubt. But God knew that they would struggle with it. He knew the church would struggle with it too. He knew that we would. Which is why we have all of these letters that were written in the New Testament specifically to address us when we do things that are right in our own eyes. So this, none of this is a shock to God. It's appalling to Him, but none of it's a shock to Him. And just the fact that we have this New Testament that really shows us these things and shows us how to deal with these things indicates that God understands. And so unlike the friend I mentioned before that, hey, God is cool with it, because I'm being honest. God is not cool with it, but He is patient. And He is gracious. And He is merciful. And He is kind. When we struggle with it. And again, I don't think I'm probably the only one that struggles with it sometimes. I still do things sometimes that are right in my own eyes. I'm not happy about it. Certainly not, don't think it's a good thing and that God is cool with it. But I know that because I still have, as Dustin calls it, this, what's it called, a meat suit, this flesh, we struggle. I'm going to give you one passage of Scripture that I think, if there's a way to sort of help with this, okay, it's this. James chapter 4, verses 7 through 10. James is dealing in chapter 4 and 5 of the book with tension among believers. In fact, he even got to the point where he said some of them had murdered within the church. Their hatred, their anger, their living by their flesh got so bad that somebody got killed. Okay? And the way that James tells them to deal with it is pretty simple. He says this in verses 4 through 10. He says, 7 through 10. Submit, therefore, to God. Resist the devil and he will flee from you. Draw near to God and he will draw near to you. He tells them to cleanse their hands, purify their hearts, stop having a double-sided mind, in other words, thinking two things. He says, be miserable and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned into mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves in the presence of the Lord and He will exalt you. I want to just focus on three real quick things there. Notice he says to submit to God, draw near to God, and humble yourselves. You notice a pattern there? We went through the book of Hosea a number of years ago, and it was interesting in the book of Hosea what we saw was God describing that what He really, in fact, Ecclesiastes does the same thing. He describes that what He really wants are people's hearts. And when He has control of your heart, that's when God can work. And so as you think about this struggle that we have, James' solution to the struggle is to submit to God, to draw near to Him, and to humble ourselves with Him. That's something the Israelites struggled with. They were far from God because of their spiritual corruption and ultimately their moral corruption. And so, in some respects, the challenge for us is, how is it that we don't fall in the same pattern that they do? Well, I think one of the ways is to do exactly what James indicates, which is purely an Old Testament principle. Draw near to God. Draw near to Him. Give Him your heart. He's already got your life. You're saved. Great. But he needs that heart, you know? And that's something the Israelites oftentimes struggled with. All right, so I'm going to go ahead. I'm just going to close with that. And next week we'll look at the moral corruption. We have two chapters left on that. So we'll be dealing with, ultimately, where does this spiritual corruption lead? It's going to lead to moral corruption as well. And it's pretty heinous. It's a hard way to end the book because it's pretty dark what happens in the last three chapters of the book. But it's there for our purposes and there to teach and instruct us. So we will do that.